Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the January 29th, 2012 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics that I have planned for us today. First, a story I just found recently. A verdict has been reached in the Canadian case involving a Muslim honor killing of four women, so we'll discuss that, and I think you'll be pleased with the result, although, of course, the fact that the crime was committed doesn't make it a great thing, but it's a little better. Second, the Supreme Court issued an opinion in the case of U.S. versus Jones this week. The court held that attaching a GPS device to the bottom of a car is a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, and I'll unpack that statement for you and let you know what that means, and then you can think about all the GPS devices in your life and the implications. Third, 16 scientists sign on to a Wall Street Journal editorial questioning the necessity to do anything about the so-called global warming crisis. Plus, we've got the State of the Union address and the last GOP debate to discuss as well. So we've got a packed show here for you. Those of you who are attending live, if you would like to discuss these topics with us, you can call at 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. Or you can put your questions and comments in the chat room, as I see many of you are already starting to do now. People are talking about Thomas Paine in the chat room. They started even before the show started. I guess Thomas Paine would have been 275 today. And, of course, we could use him, but people who are 275 years old aren't living anymore, so we're out of luck and we're going to have to use ourselves to try to counter the evil in the world. So, without further ado, let's jump in. First of all, a good news story. You can find this news story at www.cbc.ca. It's the CBC News in Canada that was reporting this morning that a verdict was reached in the Shafia, I hope I pronounced that correctly. You think Shafia is correct?
Maybe.
Yeah. Honor killing case. And in this case, I don't know if all of you have heard of this case, there was a man and his second wife and their son who together killed the man and wife's three daughters, so the son's sisters, and the husband's first wife. And I gather that all four of the women were found in the car that I guess belonged to the family in the bottom of some body of water. I don't know if that's how they were killed because apparently they had some traumas to the head, at least three of them did, and things like this. The motive for this apparently was an honor killing, and I was wondering if, Bosch, you could tell us a little bit of what you know about honor killings. I mean, I know a little bit about what the so-called grievances of the father were. Two of the daughters had boyfriends whom they were hiding from the family because they had been prohibited to have any boyfriends. Why would they be prohibited to have boyfriends? So, you know, I mean, a lot of parents actually don't want their girls to have boyfriends, but in the Muslim religion, it's a little bit
unless they're married, you know, they shouldn't, they can't. But about honor killing, I mean, I haven't studied enough to say it, even if it's in the Quran, but it's clearly sanctioned by Islam. This idea that someone has harmed the reputation of the family in any way, and that's how they justify the murder.
And they harm the reputation of the family with respect to adherence to the religion, right?
Yeah, because women have to be,
chaste.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or else.
Right.
And therefore, them murdering them is a less of a crime than the girls doing whatever it is that they did to be murdered for.
just to give you some idea of some of the stories that I've heard about with respect to women having to be chaste before they're married, that in Wafa Sultan's book, A God Who Hates, Wafa Sultan, she talks about when she was working for a doctor, an OBGYN, in her home country. She was from Syria, right? So there what happened routinely, she said, would be these young girls who were supposed to get married. They'd be brought in to be examined by the OBGYN. They'd be snuck in the back door by female relatives who knew that there was probably something wrong. And the something wrong, more often than not, actually, was that the girl was raped by male family members.
She lost her virginity.
So that's how she lost her virginity. Wafa Sultan said that in some cases, the girls were found to be impregnated by uncles, who knows what. And so then what they'd have to do is they'd have to perform abortions, and then they'd sew the girls together up to make them look like they're still virgins. This
So they can still technically bleed.
Yeah, so this is how insanely concerned they are with this issue of chastity before marriage.
I mean, they're not really, but it's the pretense of it.
Yeah.
You know, the pretense. I mean, they can rape and do whatever they want, but as long as the girl doesn't ruin their it's the opposite of the truth. It's not honor killing. It's absolutely dishonorable. It's evil, but they have to slap on those names, like, you know, as Martin writes again, Islam means peace, and murdering unchaste women means morality, means something moral, something good.
Yeah. So one of the girls, apparently she wanted to marry her boyfriend, but of course she wasn't going to be allowed to marry the man of her choice. She was going to be subjected to an arranged marriage. And I think one of them had escaped, gone to a women's shelter. And she was coaxed back by the family on the promise that they would let her marry the guy. And then, of course, they arranged to have them killed.
This took a long time for the verdict, didn't it? This happened last year, I think.
I think it happened a couple of years ago. But
it's
very typical for a trial to take a long time.
Think about it. It's not just one individual going. It's a family getting together and murdering four women.
Yeah.
And being totally justified in their own mind about it.
So that's the horribleness, the case. But the good news is that all three, the husband, the wife, the son, were found guilty of first-degree murder. They were sentenced to four terms, but they served them consecutively. So they're going to be in for at least 25 years before they have the possibility of parole. Somebody cynically wrote back to me when I posted this before and said, oh, well, they'll just appeal it and then they'll get something in a few years. I don't think so with respect to multiple grisly murders committed by this family.
This is a conspiracy. I mean, they all got together and they planned this.
This is as evil as it gets. So let's listen to what Judge Robert Maringer said. And I don't have an audio. If I say listen, it sounds like I'm going to give you an audio of him, but it's going to be me reading what he said. He said, quote, it's difficult to conceive of a more despicable, more heinous crime. And then he said, the apparent reason behind these cold-blooded, shameful murders was that the four completely innocent victims offended your twisted sense of honor. That has absolutely no place in any civilized society. End quote.
Let me say this also to those who like to think that the threat is only jihadists. These people are not jihadists, this family.
Mm-hmm.
But they're totally justified in their evil and their murder, you know, and murderous actions with Islam. They don't have to go out there and try to kill infidels and whatnot, but this is the evil that they're living in a civilized country as well. This is not the Middle East.
I was very glad to see this verdict. I was very glad to see the judge deliver it in no uncertain terms. So at least this much is a bit of good news. And from what I understand, there was, when I went on to the website, that cbc.ca, and read the story, there was a legal expert who was commenting towards the end, you know, who happens to know the Canadian system. And I think recently there had been a change such that those terms would not be served consecutively. But the way it is for these particular defendants, those are served consecutively, but he thinks that when they do come up for parole in 25 years, that there's no chance that they're going to get it because of the heinous nature of the crime.
Also, one thing, did they try to, at least attempt to, is it on the record if they try to justify their actions through Islam? You know, did they try? They must have tried.
I think that was the kind of thing that they were saying, you know, when they were saying, I think one of them said, oh, well, I didn't drown my sister. Well, he might have been the one who hit his sister over the head because right. They had been beaten.
I didn't technically drown her.
Yeah.
But when these cases happen, the best thing about them, first of all, besides putting these scum away, is that they usually justify themselves through Islam. Through the Islamic texts, and they truly do it, and they push it. They say, "I'm even doing this in the name of Allah. You have nothing. You have no right to throw me in. You know, man's law means nothing to them." And the jury and the audience, I imagine how they take that in. I mean, they just, because the truth is out. They can't avoid that once they hear that, and they know that they speak of it with conviction. I just want to hear it on the record, like in a story. I want to hear that someone, one of them did that at least.
I didn't see anything about
probably,
that in the story.
They took it
I
out.
Just saw that they denied that they were guilty. And if they did, probably they were saying it wasn't them, it was Allah working through them
or
some such like that. We've got a call already, so let's go ahead and take that. Hello?
Hi, Amy.
Oh, hi. How are you,
Deborah? Hey, Deborah.
Good, good. Pretty angry just because of the topic that we're discussing, and I heard something that I think is worth sharing. It's some insight into the mentality of men who do these honor killings, and which often in the West they try to whitewash or not whitewash the killing, but separate it from Islam.
Right.
But that's a different story. I saw. Now, this is anecdotal, but I saw something on TV a couple years ago about honor killings. I think it might have been something that Megyn Kelly did on Fox News, but I'm not sure about that. But what I remember is what the guy said. And they were talking about talking to a pro-honor killing man about women, why they're killed for being raped, you know. And the questioner was a Western journalist and asked him, you know, she can't possibly be at fault if it's rape. It's not consensual. So why would you kill her for it? You know, she's not guilty. And the man replied that it's not a matter of guilt. He said, if you have a vase and it breaks, is there any point in keeping it? No, it's broken, so you should just throw it away.
I think I've heard that before. Oh.
Damaged goods, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, worthless.
Right, and the woman is just property, like cattle or livestock. And so once she's been raped, she's no good anymore. So you just got to get rid of her. You know, it's like an individual.
And even before, you know, even before the rape, I mean, women are a necessary evil. They bring in, you know, male Muslim heirs, period. I mean, that's the extent of their worth.
Right, and if they can't do that,
they're worthless.
There's one other reason within doctrine that I understand is why this happens. Because if a woman alleges that she's been raped, then that means that she's in effect admitted adultery if she can't prove the rape.
Yep.
And
right.
The way and they have to have four witnesses in order to prove the rape.
Who are usually
so
in
once,
line.
Yeah, so once they fail in producing the four witnesses for the rape, then suddenly they're on record as having admitted to have sex outside of marriage. And
doesn't matter how, why,
yeah,
what.
It doesn't matter how. She can't prove it was a rape, so therefore she's admitted
she
adultery.
She has committed a crime. By being raped,
right, and then they stone him to death or something.
And this
for
is,
being an
you know, this is Islam, you know, this is the evil of Islam.
Yeah,
it's not that any extremists as people try to, you know.
So I mean, this should make anyone think. If you have any so-called moderate Muslim friends in various families, and then I think recently there was an honor killing situation in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Where
the
father who was separated. No, this was just, I think, this past Christmas, right? All the details haven't unfolded yet.
He killed both of his daughters?
Not only the daughters, like a whole bunch of people were killed. And he killed himself, I think, at the end.
Dressed as Santa.
And they thought he was, you know, a moderate Muslim, and he goes over there and kills everybody.
Mike.
Right, so, and I remember hearing about that over Christmas, but they didn't say anything about it having been a Muslim, and they didn't say the name because it's Ahmed Aziz. Or,
I remember
really
a little of the story, but I don't remember too much of the story myself. I remember the Santa Claus.
Well, and they weren't telling us so many of the details. There was some speculation from some of the girls' classmates and that sort of thing. So we're not going to hear everything fully until I think the trial.
And,
trial. He's done.
It's also point. They all use things. They use cars. They use planes. They use even a Santa Claus suit to get past people's, to get past them and just kill them. I mean, he actually dressed in a whole Santa suit and went there and.
Yeah, he went there, and then I think they thought he
unawares.
Was bringing gifts.
And then he brought
Islam. So I guess he went out to, the car as if he was going to go get gifts and went and got this huge automatic weapon or whatever. So, I mean, what's the moral here? It's not the case that every moderate Muslim out there is ready to do this at any time, but.
There was the other famous story about the quote-unquote moderate Muslim from Canada, another one a few years ago, who actually ran a TV station that was geared towards trying to prove that Islam is, moderate and all that, and he ended up cutting his wife's head off because she left him. And this is, he was moderate up until he cut his wife's head off, quote-unquote moderate.
I mean, all I can say is that if you have friends, if you yourself are a family member in a so-called moderate Muslim household and you're trying to push the envelope and, integrate yourself into American culture like normal Americans, and you sense any, trouble with the disapproval, maybe get yourself out and don't be coaxed back.
I've said this before about women also, just to push the misogyny in Islam.
Yeah.
Arranged marriage is very, very common, even in my upbringing.
Oh, yeah. Arranged marriages need to be outlawed.
Arranged marriage, and also
no one should be forced
mothers
to
telling
marry
their daughters
anybody.
Just getting it prepared. Your husband's going to beat you. Just deal with it. Accept it, the woman at the wedding, at least this is Albanian Muslims. I don't know if it's across the Middle East, but they literally stand for 6 hours during their wedding looking down, sweating buckets, and just that's
all
they
do. Well, that's nothing compared to what's to come.
But then also, brother-in-laws getting together looking for women.
To cheat on their wives.
Looking to
with.
Cheat on their wives
yeah.
with on their sisters and
yeah.
with their sisters.
Yeah,
because
cheating is just such a part of life. Yeah.
I mean, this is it's total. I mean, they're considered evil. That's
Yeah.
And they
in,
make men rape. They make men do bad things. I mean,
in this Shafia case, one of the women who was killed was the first wife of the man who was convicted. The husband. So I thought that was interesting. Why was she tagging along with them and living with them in Canada? She had followed them through three countries, and I don't believe
maybe they were
still
married.
She wasn't really the mother of any of the kids, although supposedly the second wife gave one baby to her to raise as
her
own.
Well, he could have had two more besides those two wives also, officially.
If he could have handled it, I guess, supposedly.
Well, maybe she was afraid to leave him.
Yeah. But,
maybe.
I mean, I think this is a very good, strong precedent to set and send this out there. Send this message from this judge, Maranga, out there and just let everybody know that this is not tolerated. We are not a society of moral relativism where we say, okay, well, in your society, for preserving the honor of the family, I guess you just have to do these things. And they shouldn't be given any sort of reduced sentence or say, oh, well, really, they didn't have, the required motive for first-degree murder, right? They didn't have the premeditation and et cetera. This was first-degree murder in Canada. They didn't say, oh, it's second-degree murder because it's so-called understandable. Second-degree murder, sometimes they'll give it when a man walks in on the girl, his girlfriend or wife, whatever, cheating with his best friend and he flies in a rage. Sometimes they'll do a second-degree murder in that kind of situation. And I think sometimes, sometimes they've tried to have, Muslims say, it's not it's not like we really could help it. We were carried away with emotion, just like the guy who finds the girlfriend in bed with somebody else or something. And, obviously you're still guilty of murder, but sometimes they make distinctions based on the degree of premeditation and the degree of, I guess, so-called understandable outrage.
Is this verdict considered controversial? Have you read anyone in Canada? Have they said that this is
the few comments that I saw on the story, they seem to be positive about it.
Okay.
But, like I said, I post this out on Twitter and then somebody tweets back and says, they're just going to appeal it and then they'll just get a few years. And to me, I'm more optimistic than that. But I don't know the Canadian legal system well enough. The one guy who did in the comments said that he doubts whether they'll even get let out on parole. So, any more thoughts on this one?
Really, I'm pleasantly surprised by the verdict. I mean, yeah. Like you said, it's terrible what happened, but given what happened, the fact that the judge spoke in such clear moral terms, just really denouncing them, I was a little surprised because I know that in Canada, I think they have even laws against hate speech and things of that kind.
Do.
And I think Mark Stein has gotten into some kind of trouble up there.
He did.
Even for speaking out against Islam. So I think it's a very good sign that even in that environment, there was a judge who would give such a strong verdict or strong pronouncement and the jury would convict them. So at least that part's good news, I guess.
I saw this story just this morning, so what we should do is follow it over the days and weeks to come and see if the judge gets any heat.
Appeals.
You know, if there are these appeals or anything like that, if he backs off the judgment. But this is excellent because it speaks out entirely against moral relativism. You know, moral relativism. It says, look, here in a civilized country, there is no so-called right to kill female members of your family because they're not behaving according to whatever your weird religious rules are. It's ridiculous. It is murder. It's murder. It's murder, regardless of what you say comes out of your religious traditions.
And also one thing, you know, the Muslim community of Canada, quote unquote, the Muslim community, I hate that term, but whatever. Are they protesting this? Are they? Because they should be Islamically fine with it. I mean, with them murdering the girls. But with this verdict, are they going to they're going to protest it in some way, some form? Whether
certainly it's discrimination.
They're going to use this as a point.
I don't know. I haven't heard any of that yet. All I've heard is the verdict, and I've heard that, of course, they pled not guilty, but their standard in a trial is beyond a reasonable doubt, and the jury had to find beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to all the various elements, which include motive, opportunity, means, and all those sorts of things where, they had to show that these three all plotted and carried out this horrible murder of four women. So, anyway, we'll see, Deborah. We'll see.
Yeah. All
Anything
right.
Else?
Well, thanks.
Okay, we're going to go on to some more interesting stuff, so feel free to chime in again later. Thank you. So, any more on this, Bosch?
Nothing.
No, I think it speaks for itself.
I mean, it's even to think, well, this is a good thing that they're, I know what you mean, but man.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really say it's good because it shouldn't have had to happen in the first place.
The just
right?
thing would have been if those four women turned around and killed them before they killed them, That would have been absolute justice.
Well, that's why they needed all three of them, because if you've got four women, you figure four women together could do something. We have another legal case. Yeah, Bosch is going to go to sleep. Actually, maybe you're not. Maybe this case is also interesting enough to keep you involved.
Okay.
This is United States versus Jones.
Is it about
Jones.
Comic books?
It's not about comic books.
Oh.
It's about something that could be in a comic book, though.
Okay.
So imagine in a comic book that the police put a GPS device on the bottom of the evil bad guy's car.
Yes.
Okay? And so then the police got the location information from the evil bad guy's car and used that information to convict the evil bad guy.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Yes.
Interesting?
Yes. No, you got me.
Okay. Except for the fact that the evil bad guy was probably just a drug dealer.
Oh.
And in fact, I was surprised. The particular drug crimes of this defendant, Antoine Jones, were so serious that when he was convicted originally, he was assigned a life imprisonment sentence for his drug crime.
What was his drug crime?
Some sort of dealing and...
lifetime imprisonment.
Yeah, let's see. This is what he had. At the conspirator's stash house, they had $850,000 in cash, 97 kilos of cocaine, and 1 kilo of cocaine base. So it's probably based on quantity and federal drug law and all that stuff. So that's what's going on here. You've got the police using this GPS device. And the big question is, did the police violate the Fourth Amendment when they used this device? So let's back up and get some little bit of context about the Fourth Amendment. Many of you know United States Fourth Amendment protects people, their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. That's what the Fourth Amendment does. And then you have to unpack that language and say, well, what is an unreasonable search? And in United States, it's been presumptively held that if you don't have a warrant, if you search without a warrant, then that is per se unreasonable. There are exceptions where you can have a warrantless search that is reasonable, but there's certain defined exceptions, okay? In this case, in this U.S. versus Jones case, there was a warrant issued for the police to go ahead and put the GPS device on the bottom of the car, but what happened is that the police did not adhere to the terms of the warrant. So the police were given the permission to install the device in the District of Columbia, and they had to do it within 10 days. Instead, they installed it in Maryland, and they did it on the 11th day.
Okay.
So if you violate the terms of the warrant, that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, the warrant has to be issued on probable cause, and you have to have reasonable terms in the warrant, and the police have to adhere to the terms of the warrant. So here, presumably, there was probable cause for the warrant. The police, the terms of the warrant were reasonable, but the police did not adhere to the terms of the warrant, so it may as well have been a warrantless search, if it is indeed a search.
Right.
So then the next question is, does this amount to a search? And so far, the lower courts have been holding no. And in fact, the district court in this case that, you know, originally convicted Jones held that no, it was not a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. So if something doesn't rise to the level of a search, then the Fourth Amendment doesn't even apply. If the Fourth Amendment does apply and they find that the police have conducted an unreasonable search or seizure, I think you know from watching all your Law and Order episodes what happens, right? What's the remedy?
Well, you tell me.
What's the remedy, people? Someone in the chat room, type in, what's the remedy if they find that the Fourth Amendment was violated? The primary remedy for people.
No one seems to be typing anything.
I've got no one typing anything. They're all thinking. We should play like Jeopardy music or something.
I'll start singing.
Okay, you sing. No one is telling us.
Well,
okay, so what they have is they have the exclusionary rule, right? Everybody knows from watching episodes of Law and Order that if the court throws out the evidence on a Fourth Amendment violation, that's called the exclusionary rule. That has been the main remedy ever since at least the 60s it's been applied. There is, of course, the ability to have a civil suit. You can say, for instance, that they committed trespass or violated your Fourth Amendment rights, but they're going to do Commerce Clause in here. I don't know. I don't know where they brought up the Commerce Clause in the chat room, but yeah.
Thrown out. Let's talk about Islam again if you want me to contribute, Derek says.
He knows enough about that, but not about this. Yeah, so the point is that if they find there was a search and then the search was conducted without a warrant, they throw out the evidence, and the whole conviction is gone. It's overturned, the life sentence gone. He gets off free if that's the evidence that was used to convict him for his 97 kilos of cocaine and all that stuff. So indeed, the Court of Appeals overturned the district court conviction saying that there was a search, and the Supreme Court agreed. Affirmed that there was a search in this case. And then the interesting thing is the rationale for this. Some people have heard me talk about this in the past, or you have heard it elsewhere. The test for whether there's a search under the Fourth Amendment comes from a 1967 case called Katz versus United States, and it's the famous reasonable expectation of privacy test. And I think you've heard me talk about this before, Bosch. Yeah, so the test asks, first of all, whether you actually do have an expectation of privacy. And then the second prong is whether that expectation is one that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable. And mostly since 1967, they have held that the Katz test is the sole test for determining whether a search has occurred under the Fourth Amendment. So they say, okay, was there a search in this case? If there was a search, there had to be a warrant unless you fall under one of the exceptions. Otherwise, there's a violation of the Fourth Amendment and all the evidence is out. So that's kind of the train of reasoning. In 2001, there was a case called Kelo. And in the Kelo case...
How many kilos? I'm joking.
Yeah, no kilos. It's
K-Y-L-L-O.
And in the... Actually, it was a drug case as well. There's so many drug cases in Fourth Amendment, it's scary.
Kilos.
In Kelo, though, some people were growing marijuana in their home.
Right.
And so they had all these heat lamps, you know, with this beautiful crop of marijuana growing in their home under all these heat lamps. And so the government was able to get across the street on a public street and use a heat detecting device that they pointed towards the home and detect all this heat coming off the roof and everything else. So Scalia, in that case, held in effect, he said that even though there's this reasonable expectation of privacy test, he says that there's also something more, which is that we will protect at least that degree of privacy that was protected in the founding of this country. And so in particular, when you have in the Fourth Amendment houses listed, you know, your person, persons, houses, papers, and effects, right? Your house, your home is going to get that degree of protection for, you know, under privacy protection.
So they broke that.
They thought that, it, you know, this reasonable expectation language has to accommodate the fact that part of that is that your home is going to have the same degree of protection it normally had. And the government could not figure out how much heat was going on in your house without these special tricky devices. They couldn't get this information except by actually going into the house, entering the house.
Right.
And so therefore that was a search. Similarly here, what Scalia does in this case is he latches on to the term of the Fourth Amendment that says effects, your person, houses, papers, and effects. And he appeals to precedent, Supreme Court precedent, in which your car was held to be an effect.
Right.
It is something that you own, a piece of personal private property. And so Scalia says that that property, that effect of yours, is trespassed upon when they place this GPS device underneath your car. No matter where your car is, your car could be parked on a public street or whatever, but it is still your effect. It is still your property. And so therefore...
Did the police speak at all? Did they we wanted a sure bet, a sure arrest, a sure thing? I mean,
well, of course, I mean,
are itching to
you know, there's so many times that the police can get ultra reliable evidence by violating all of our rights. I mean, right now, you know, you could have the government plug into Facebook and know what all of us are thinking and sharing with our friends all the time. All kinds of wonderful, perfectly reliable evidence if we had total surveillance all the time. But we have a tradition in our country of requiring particularized suspicion and adherence to certain procedures that require a judge, an impartial arbiter, in advance of going in for these searches, right? You need this impartial judge to look over what the police say that they have as probable cause and everything else. You want that, you know, that bit of procedure to save us. So here what Scalia says, he says, at least we should be entitled to, you know, that degree of privacy that we had at the time of the founding. He says the government physically occupied private property for the purpose of obtaining information. And he says that property rights have always been significant in search and seizure analysis. And he and this is where Scalia, I've got a little passage here, where Scalia brings in his own type of constitutional interpretation. And for more on this, if you're interested in constitutional interpretation theory, I would look at Tara Smith's work. She has done a lot of work on this. And she classifies Scalia as an original meaning theorist. I think Scalia actually classifies himself as that, but what Tara Smith does is she unpacks that and critiques it in a very effective way. Scalia says that we want to interpret the Constitution according to what the founders meant you know, the framers of the Constitution meant by the language of the amendment itself. So here's the passage from the Jones opinion. He says, "The text of the Fourth Amendment reflects its close connection to property, since otherwise it would have referred simply to, quote, the right of the people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures," and end quote. He says the phrase "in their persons, houses, papers, and effects" would have been superfluous. And I think he's right, you know, that by putting those words in there, that they meant something. Now, some people have said, well, all that is protected is your persons, houses, papers, and effects. What now they do with this Katz test and what Scalia is proposing here is that he's saying that we can have the concrete protection of persons, houses, papers, and effects, protect those to that degree of protection that we had at the time of, you know, the framing of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and as an overlay for cases that don't seem to clearly fall under an unreasonable search or seizure of a person, house, paper, and effect, we will lay on top of that the option of going through the Katz test, this unreasonable expectation, or, you know, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy? If you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, even though your case doesn't fall neatly under a person, house, paper, or effect, then you might still be protected. That's the rule that Scalia is trying to have. So he's trying to say, you know, look, this idea of reasonableness doesn't tell the whole story. You're going to have that reasonableness criteria as a supplement, but you're going to at least be guaranteed that degree of protection that we had at the nation's founding. There was in one of the concurrences a objection of, you know, going back to this old 18th century trespass doctrine. You know, how dare they bring in property? For me myself, because I have been arguing for years that we should have the right to privacy protected, not based on a freestanding legal right to privacy, that we should protect privacy through property and contract. So I would see this as a good development. The only problem that I see with this case, and I hope to write some more about this later, is that Scalia tries to reconcile with his holding in this case a holding in two cases before, which involved what are called beepers. Yeah. And I guess beepers are just like the old-style beepers. Yeah. But beepers just give off information as to where an item is. It's not exactly like a GPS device, but I guess it does help you hone in on the location of stuff. And there are a couple cases in which the government installed beepers in some container, and then the container was sold to an unsuspecting defendant who then used the container to do all sorts of illegal things, probably having to do with drugs, right? And so the rationale in that case was you didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Those were the holdings. Scalia tries to say, well, in that case, the beeper was added to the property while the property was not in the guy's possession, right? So, Bosch, you and I go through this. So suppose I am the company that sells the containers. The police come to me and they say, you know, we know that that Bosch, horrible drug dealer Bosch guy is coming over.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so we want, Amy, you know, we know that you are clean and sweet and you would never commit a crime. We need you to help us, right? And yeah, you're the villain. You're the bad guy. Sorry.
We need to put the kibosh on Bosch. Go on.
That's right. So we want to put these little beepers in the containers, and then you sell the container to Bosch, and then when he uses the container in his illegal, evil, horrible way, then we'll catch him.
Yeah.
Okay? Don't you think that there's a problem with that that would be similar to the problem in this case?
I guess, yeah.
Maybe. But Scalia says no, it's because of the fact that the beeper is added to the container.
Out of his...
While it was out of his possession, maybe he hadn't even bought the container yet.
No.
You see what I mean? So I don't know that that's a very good application
of
this rule.
What does colleagues say? What did they say? Have they said anything?
Well, one of the colleagues, I mean, of course, you know, there's cases that are different that haven't been reached here. And those cases were just merely trying to be reconciled, so they haven't really come up under this new framework. So Sotomayor wrote a concurring opinion. Although she signed on to this majority opinion as well, she wrote a separate concurrence to say, well, maybe these beeper cases and other cases like them indicate that we need to rethink some of the third party, sharing information with third party jurisprudence. So think about this, for example. We go out and get Siri. Yay.
Tonight.
We still haven't done it yet.
I
want to get Siri. But suppose we go get Siri, and there's all sorts of nifty tracking whatever devices in Siri, right? Apple installed them. It's only for personal use. I'm buying it for personal use. But suppose the government says, well, you know, we can use it and track you. It was installed before you got it. You willingly took possession of this thing that had these features, and Apple agreed to share the data that comes from it with the government.
Yeah. It was in the fine print.
Yeah. So why not that?
But when don't they violate all these laws anyway? I mean, government.
So I think she brings up something valid, and I think there's probably a law review article in there somewhere. It would make you rethink a lot of this jurisprudence, because the way it stands now, if you share information with a third party, then not only are you in the sense of like an informant or whatever, you're taking the risk that the guy is a government plant. That's been the case for a long time. But for instance, when you give information to your phone company or to the bank, there's certain routine turning over of information by phone companies and banks to the government that is deemed not to be a search. And that's kind of disturbing, especially when you think, for instance, that some of the information that you're turning over to these third parties now is your location with a GPS device that we're all carrying around with us, namely our phones. How do you differentiate that from the case of the Jeep here? You know?
A lot of these politicians, they project, they consider us all to be potential criminals.
I mean, you know, even the 13-year-old that put the status update on Facebook about how Obama should watch out now because Osama bin Laden's friends would, you know, try to find him or something,
right.
And then the federal agents come to his school to question him.
Right.
They don't even wait for his parents to show up to question him.
That's
unbelievable. This 13-year-old kid or something. So I think that we are going to have a little more rigorous treatment of these types of cases and what's going on in them because, and it's not that we have to have new doctrines, but because the technology has changed and improved in various ways, we're going to have to start thinking more about how the same doctrines apply, because I think we can use these contract
You can always
property.
Adapt them to this.
I mean, we have a contract with Apple. We have a contract with Apple. Apple is supposed to, or the different applications are supposed to, use the information only to serve our purposes as consumers. They're not supposed to be turning information over the government, I think, unless there's particularized suspicion. I would not, you know, if I write the doctrine, I wouldn't invade someone's so-called, you know, contract or privacy, the privacy provisions of a contract, unless there was particularized suspicion. And I don't see why you shouldn't have the same analogy. Why isn't your contract with your doctor, with your phone company, with your bank, why isn't that an effect of yours? It's intangible, sure. But why does it have to be tangible?
We're leaning towards that kind of world, though. I mean, with the government, how big it is, how corrupt the politicians are.
There's a lot of people talking about the war on drugs. And then Deborah in the chat room says, if the beeper can be installed to a device when it's out of his possession, that does not violate his privacy rights. Why not install tracking devices in everyone's car in the factory and they can monitor all of us all the time? Well, they do that now. It's called OnStar or whatever the equivalent is in the other brands. A whole lot of the cars now offer tracking devices, and part of the tracking device is necessary for the nav systems, but some of it is in there as well to, you know, help you get your car back in case of theft and all of that. Now Chris says, Amy, he says, other than the argument it's not allowed in the Constitution, thus it's disallowed, is there anything explicitly in the Constitution barring that intrusive monitoring? For instance, Apple won't stand up for our privacy rights. I'm not sure that Apple won't stand up for our privacy rights. I do know that Google resisted a subpoena when the government tried to come in and get some search data from Google. But then someone I know who is cynical, when I brought that example up, he said that the only reason that Google resisted the government subpoena was because Google wanted to cover up what it was doing in terms of invading our privacy, not giving us privacy. So I'm not sure if that's true. But, you know, in terms of the Constitution, we have it right here, the Fourth Amendment, persons, houses, papers, and effects. And we have a long history of the trespass doctrine being used as the way to indicate when a search has occurred. If the police commit a trespass, then that would signal the fact that you have a search that has occurred. If there's no warrant, then the remedy would actually be a civil suit for trespass. That's how it used to be. It didn't used to be the exclusionary rule. And I think that's part of the reason, too, that you see these doctrines morph. When they change the remedy, which is that the evidence is going to get thrown out, then they want to allow a lot more to be searched before they're going to throw the evidence out. They also say that they don't change the nature of the doctrine due to the underlying crime that was being investigated. But sometimes I think they're doing that as well. So Martin says, statism thrives on mere technicalities. Yeah, and I think that that's what Sotomayor was warning against in her concurrence. You know, again, the beeper sort of case, or the type of case that we're talking about and that she discussed in the opinion, the one about the GPS devices installed in your phones, that isn't being brought up in this case. But what if it was? And I think we're going to see that case at some point in the near future, and I'd like to see how the court would handle it. Any more questions or comments on this case? We've got just people in the chat room commenting on it this time. Richard in the chat room just says, this is a hypothetical, right? The Apple example. Yeah, it's a hypothetical, but it's a hypothetical that was discussed by Sotomayor and that you can easily imagine as a reasonable case that's going to come up, especially in light. There are two opinions, Supreme Court opinions from decades ago, Smith and Miller in the privacy jurisprudence. And I forget which one is which. One of them has to do with your bank records and the other one has to do with your phone records. And the general rule is that when you turn information over to a third party, then that third party can, of course, turn the information over to the government, which is why I always think that whenever a doctor or anybody else hands you a privacy policy, forget what you're reading. I mean, sometimes there are some teeth to the privacy policy in the sense of, well, you know, you go to a doctor's office and they say, we won't share it at all. But then there's always a caveat, unless the government tells us that we must. And that's a huge unless these days. There's all sorts of regulations that require these third-party service providers to turn information routinely over to the government. And yeah, sometimes they say it's aggregated so that it's anonymized, so that, you know, you don't appear up in it personally in these records. But I don't think that's very helpful. It's not very consoling. And under Obamacare, we've discussed many times, in Obamacare, you're going to be part of a huge database according to your Social Security number. They're going to have all your health records. So it's quite a depressing thing, but I do like the idea that Scalia is pushing back to try and protect at least that amount of privacy that we had at the founding. The question is, can he do it in a principled way without kicking out the Katz reasonable expectation of privacy doctrine? He makes it explicit in his opinion, his majority opinion, that he doesn't want his doctrine to be the sole doctrine on which a search is determined. He wants to have Katz, you know, available there as a supplement. But I don't myself see the need to have that as a supplement. I would rather have things determined clearly on the basis of trespass and contract. And then I'd like to have our, you know, property and contract respected to the degree necessary so that we can protect our privacy via property and contract. I mean, that's one of the huge things. Anyway, if people want to hear more about this, you can come take my class this summer. I'm going to teach an optional course at OCON where I'll talk more about privacy and not just the legal aspects of it, but the value of it and some trickier cases, which, you know, as I said, there's going to be a lot of tricky cases to come. So we're done with law and Bosch is back.
Yay,
did you have to go kind of get your blood circulated and flowing? And yeah. Okay. So now we get to talk about global warming. Global
so
warming.
So we get to talk about nothing.
Yeah, okay. Basically. The arbitrary. Yeah. That's what we're going to talk about, the arbitrary.
About the non-existent.
Mm-hmm. There is a Wall Street Journal editorial dated January 27th, and it is signed by 16 scientists at the end of the article. It is called No Need to Panic About Global Warming. And they're writing it, I guess, in effect for these candidates, I guess in part for Obama, not that Obama listened, judging by his State of the Union address, but also for the benefit of the GOP candidates.
Do these scientists have a history of talking against global warming, but, critical of it?
I'm not aware of the history of all these
scientists. Or they basically, within the last
scientists.
Year, it's just not popular enough anymore, so they're
I think that more and more of them are feeling like they can buck the trend.
They might have to save themselves, their credibility also, some of them.
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be that. But I tend to take them at their word. And
the trend is going against it.
Yeah, well, I think the trend is now going against it, but
absolutely
then what's
right.
going to happen after this, I don't know.
So they want to go on record, some of them.
Yeah, 16 of them are going on record, and I think, based on what they write here, that they're in fear for their careers
exactly.
by doing this.
Well,
but
they're actually doing this to save their careers.
Yeah, if they want to have credibility as scientists, they should. So this is what they say. They say, candidates for public office should understand that the oft-repeated claim that nearly all scientists demand that something dramatic be done to stop global warming is not true. In fact, a large and growing number of distinguished scientists and engineers do not agree that drastic actions on global warming are needed. And then they talk about a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Ivar Giaver.
Giver.
He's a supporter of President Obama from the last election, but he publicly resigned from the American Physical Society, APS, with a letter that begins, and this is him. He says, I did not renew my membership because I cannot live with the APS policy statement.
The statement being?
And here's the APS policy statement. They said, the evidence is incontrovertible. Global warming is occurring. If no mitigating actions are taken, significant disruptions in the Earth's physical and ecological systems, social systems, security, and human health are likely to occur. We must reduce emissions of greenhouse gases beginning now, end quote.
Disruptions.
Yes. So that was the statement of the American Physical Society.
He rejected.
Yeah, Ivar Giaver, he says, no, I'm out. I'm not going to do this. And he says, in the APS, it is okay to discuss whether the mass of proton changes over time and how a multi-universe behaves, but the evidence of global warming is incontrovertible, end quote. So he's saying, look, why is this some dogma that I can't question? So then they're saying these 16 scientists say that the number of scientific heretics is growing with each passing year.
But also, a lot of them, they desperately want to believe it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's like they want to believe it. And if someone, it's like their dream or something.
Inverted
dream.
And then these 16, they speculate as to the motive, which we'll talk about in a few as well. Now, they said that the reason that the number of heretics is growing is because there is a collection of stubborn scientific facts. And not coincidentally, I'm sure, they used the word inconvenient,
right.
This adjective, to describe the sort of facts
right.
that are stubborn. It says, perhaps the most inconvenient fact is the lack of global warming for well over 10 years now. This is part, from the ClimateGate email from 2009. But they say that, the warming that they expect, yeah, it's missing, but it's only missing if you believe that the computer models are correct, right? That, supposedly the clouds are amplifying the small effect of the CO2, et cetera, et cetera. But this is obviously not true. They say the computer models have greatly exaggerated how much warming additional CO2 can cause. And in fact, CO2 is not a pollutant. And I did learn something when I read this article, something that I didn't know about CO2. It says that plants and animals evolved when CO2 concentrations were about 10 times larger than they are today.
Interesting.
And they also suspect that some of the increased productivity in terms of crops and plant life recently is because of the increased amount of CO2.
Hmm.
So it may have actually been helping.
So they're wrong?
Yeah. Many young scientists will furtively say that while they also have serious doubts about global warming, they're afraid to speak up. And in this article, they give the example, a Dr. Chris DeFreitas, he was the editor of the Journal of Climate Research. He dared to publish a peer review article with a politically incorrect but factually correct conclusion that the recent warming is not unusual in the context of climate changes over the past 1,000 years. And it says the international warming establishment quickly mounted a determined campaign to have him removed from his editorial job and fired from his university position. Fortunately, they said that he was able to keep his university job. I guess he was fired from the editorial position. And obviously, they say this is not the way science is supposed to work, but we have seen it before. And then they give a similar example. In the Soviet Union, you had Lysenko. I think I've heard about this, the Lysenko era of biology in the Soviet Union. Soviet biologists who revealed that they believed in genes, right? The Gregor Mendel discovery of genes, which Lysenko maintained was a bourgeois fiction, were fired from their jobs. Mm. Many were sent to the gulag, and some were condemned to death. So this happens. Now, then the question is, what is the motive? And they say that the motive here is the money, that it's about money.
I mean, it's very likely. I mean, look at Al Gore. He became a rich man.
Yeah, and that was part of what he was doing. But then also they say that because alarmism over climate induces the government to fund academic research.
Absolutely.
And so all this money is being provided so long as you support the party line.
Rush was talking about politics also, but we're getting money for doing nothing. That's their goal. Not just, you know, earning, you know, for doing nothing and pretend that they're doing something.
Well, but they're not just doing nothing, because they're doing harm.
Oh,
I mean,
what I'm saying is the work. They're not doing anything.
Right.
I mean, they're not, literally.
But what they're doing
of course,
is tremendously harmful.
But like politicians as well, though, they go to Washington, they're not rich, they leave Washington, they're filthy rich. And I mean that, filthy, you know, when it comes to them.
So again, they reiterate the messages for the candidates for public office. They say there is no compelling scientific argument for drastic action to decarbonize the world's economy, even if one accepts the inflated climate forecasts of the IPCC, which they don't. They say aggressive greenhouse gas control policies are not justified economically. And then they talk about, in terms of economic studies, even if you accepted all the bogus stuff is true, they say the highest benefit-to-cost ratio is achieved for a policy that allows 50 more years of economic growth unimpeded by greenhouse gas controls.
Even presidential candidate Mitt Romney believes in this crap.
Romney does?
He says,
and where is Gingrich? Because he sat on the couch.
I think
with
when
Pelosi.
He sat on the couch, he lost his brain. But when he got off the couch, I think he's okay now. I think.
Okay.
He sat on the couch with Nancy Pelosi and said, we don't agree on everything, but we do agree on global war. You know.
And then he's changed his mind since.
I guess. He said it was the most stupid thing he ever done. Yeah, right. Because it was a public thing. It was embarrassment. Anyway.
So then they suggest that if elected officials feel compelled to do something about climate,
which I love.
Someone must have been influenced by Rand or somebody here. They say, we recommend supporting the excellent scientists who are increasing our understanding of climate with well-designed instruments on satellites, et cetera. And it's true. I mean, the prediction abilities of the climate scientists is not what it could be. I mean, we could have more accurate warnings with respect to hurricanes and tornadoes and all those sorts of things.
If you want to
invest money in that. But of course, again, what we're talking about here is government-sponsored research. And they're still on the premise that the government-sponsored research should be used somewhere. So, why not have it be this? And then they close off. They say, every candidate should support rational measures to protect and improve our environment.
Yeah.
So, see, they're still coming from the environmental premise. But
they can't let it go fully.
You know, they can't fully let it go. And this is the thing. I mean, the money motive is only part of the answer, clearly. The biggest answer is that this money is flowing because people believe they need to sacrifice themselves and their prosperity for the sake of
and
the so-called environment.
Somewhere that seems good.
Yeah.
So dump it there.
Yeah.
And I feel better.
So certainly, you know, Mother Earth, nature, it's so beautiful. We have to preserve it. We can't have major disruptions, right, in our ecological system. That would just be terrible. And so certainly we have to all sacrifice and pay a whole lot of tax money to create huge bureaucracies. And, yeah, sometimes the money ends up in the hands of a cylinder that goes bankrupt and who knows where the money went. But that's just the price to pay for being a morally good person because, you know, we have the best intentions, of course, right?
There's a global Captain Planet, like, skit. It's a video. It came out, I think, last year. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's the true Captain Planet doing what he probably, you know, always dreams of doing. It's available on YouTube. I forgot the actor. He's Cheadle.
Mm-hmm.
Don Cheadle?
Don Cheadle. Don That's Cheadle. Right. That's right.
It was disturbing and funny.
Because it shows what the true motives are. And the question is, how much did they really understand?
I don't know. I mean, did they know what they were doing? Is Don Cheadle a global warming, you know, or what is he? It was just weird, disturbing, and funny.
Matt in the chat room says, I love scientific data proposing drastic changes over a 20-year period based on 0.00003% of the Earth's climate history. Exactly. They've got what is...
Yeah, and Robert also brings up this in the 70s. Yeah. It's true. The coming ice age, Time magazine was pushing it. You know, this is a joke. I mean, it's just... rats getting together and just trying to push us towards something that isn't. And again, when they talk about the global warming crisis, the Islamophobia crisis, we have a truth crisis in this country. I mean, so many levels, beginning with our leaders. I mean, that's the crisis.
And basically any of this is an excuse to call for sacrifice, which is an excuse to tax us and create big government bureaucracies and then start to, you know, have people in power who can dictate who gets the money and the jobs and the editorial positions at the journals. And there is so much government funding of scientific research now,
and also,
that government agendas is pushing.
It's so woozy and vague also that they can't prove it. So therefore, in their mind, it'll be never ending, this boondoggle. You know what I mean? It'll be never ending. They can keep,
Well, especially if they get the arbitrary argument on their side, right?
So that's what they want.
They say, I say that global warming exists. Prove that it doesn't.
Yes, exactly right.
And if they can get you to think that
no
you have the
it.
Burden of proof to prove that it doesn't exist.
It's getting warm in here. Right?
It is kind of warm in here, actually.
I believe.
You believe in global warming?
I guess right now.
Okay.
In this moment.
It's not like we have this light or anything like that that's making it.
Okay.
The light that we turned on.
Okay, good.
The light that's going to be illegal soon, right? The incandescent bulbs.
Well, yeah, it's...
Michael says, save the polar bears, embrace socialism. As if that's going to help.
Polar bears are socialists, though.
I've seen other articles and I think videos I've watched in which they talk about the fact that even if we did make certain cutbacks, huge, drastic cutbacks, that would make no perceivable difference.
Come on.
And that, in fact, if we left everything alone and instead we had a very thriving economy, that the thriving economy is the best way for people to be able to deal with any of the climate changes that might occur.
Absolutely, because they can invent things, create things, and, you know...
Everybody can afford air conditioning for when we have a little bit of a hotter summer or whatever it is.
But also, they take this fact that things are getting a little warmer, right? And therefore, we can stop it from doing so because it will eventually burn us all. I don't know if anyone out there saw it. I saw a preview for a movie. It was a Val Kilmer movie. It was a global warming movie where he threw a number of people into a room and slowly heated the room more and more to prove that what? I don't know. And they were fighting each other.
That global warming
each other.
Will cause a security threat. That's what they always talk about. They talk about a security threat that will be a result of global warming.
The commercial
warming.
Was so bad. The preview. Wow. I forgot the name of it.
Now, I think Martin in the chat room goes a little bit overboard here. He says, we should improve our environment. Usually that means asphalting things and building power plants and mega malls.
He's...
So, maybe not. We do have
He's
a caller.
Joking.
Let's go ahead and see if we've got a caller on this topic. Are you in favor of asphalt and mega malls? Hello?
Amy?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Speaking about the global warming, there was a, in the discussion so far this evening, there was an issue that's not, has not been raised, but that for me gives the death knell of this whole issue.
Is this, is this Richard, by the way?
Yes.
Ooh, that was, right. Was that good of me to recognize your voice or what? I thought that was good. You haven't called us in a while. Hello.
Yes. Hi. How you doing?
Doing fine. So tell us what the issue is that we need to discuss.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, based on the models, predicts a certain type of signature above the equator. There would be a rise of temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be going up and down a little bit to the North Pole and the South Pole. Trouble is, this does, the actual data does not show this signature of this, this so-called hot spot.
Now, is this data the data that resulted in that ClimateGate email series a couple years ago?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it, what I'm looking at is this graph B was published by the U.S. Climate Change Science Program.
So our own Climate Change Science Program has information out there available for you to look at right now on the web that contradicts their whole theory.
Well, I don't know if it's on the web. I'm looking at a publication here that that shows these two graphs, and I'll quote. Graph B, published by the U.S. Climate Change Science Program, shows what actually occurred during the recent warming from 1979 to 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Weather balloons measured the global atmosphere but could find no sign of the predicted hotspot.
Wow.
So, I mean, I'm a scientist. I was an engineer, and I did experiments. And if the theory, if the data contradicts the models, you throw out the models.
Right.
And
yeah.
To me, this contradiction, where the models predict this hotspot above the equator, and when the data does not show it, to me it's very simple. You throw out the models and say, come back with the model that predicts the hotspot.
Yeah,
and
you've got to
you've
got to change your model to account for the data.
Right, and you have to recognize basically the facts. This is what the data is showing. And
right.
If the models cannot show this, then the models are out. No ifs, ands, or buts. And to me, when I saw this, this was it. That this whole thing is wrong. And I just wanted to bring this up and raise this issue of the hotspot.
And that you're bringing up is probably just one of several pieces of information that these 16 scientists here in the Wall Street Journal were referring to when they just say there's a bunch of inconvenient facts for the global warming scientists. I don't even know where Al Gore is hiding himself these days, because I think it's just too hard for him to keep maintaining that this is such an issue. I loved hearing the various stories that we did, that he was going to some sort of conference, on global warming, and then he was snowed
coldest
in
day of the year,
and coldest
literally.
Day ever.
Hilarious.
So things kept, obviously little anecdotes like that don't show anything, but when you have data collected over time that refuse to conform to their models, then, I love the fact they say, well, even if those models were correct and we were going to experience a gradual increase in temperature, nonetheless, the method of dealing with this would not be to put all these constraints and taxes and everything on the economy, but instead allow the economy to thrive so that people would best be able to deal with the climate change, because we're, you know, we're talking about supporting human life here. We're not talking about preserving the environment for the sake of some intrinsic value of the environment. You know, the environment's of value because it gives us a place to live and thrive and enjoy ourselves.
Has anyone seen the videos of the environmentalists who are mourning the death of a tree?
I've seen something like that.
I don't think it's a joke. Well, I think it's actual real, by the way.
Yeah, and even the increase in carbon dioxide, trees grow better. Plants grow more.
Yeah, that's what they were saying in here. That was something that I didn't realize, is that the plants and the animals evolved when they said there was 10 times more CO2 in the atmosphere when plants and animals evolved than there is today. So today, part of the reason we might have problems, you know, certain animals and plants go extinct, is because we don't have enough CO2 for them. Are you there, Richard?
That could be. But, you know, the increase in carbon dioxide certainly helps, and I think even the data shows this, you get more trees, you get more wood.
I think they were saying that they pump in CO2 into greenhouses to get a better plant output when they're trying to, you know, grow some crops in greenhouses. So seems pretty clear.
Yeah. So anyway, I couldn't help but call in and mention the hotspot.
No, thank you very much. And then how do you feel that our president completely ignored any of this reality in the State of the Union address this week, when he kept pushing for clean energy and things that we have to do to address climate change and all of that? He keeps pressing for it.
Unbelievable. It doesn't live in
well, it's he as others who are advocating this are basically evading the facts. I mean, when you have the facts about the increase in carbon dioxide and its benefits, when you evade the fact of the hotspot and other issues, and I think some of these scientists in this Wall Street Journal editorial allude to that, it's not just one issue that they're overlooking, or one might say evading, and that seriously affects how you can judge Obama and the advocates who want these controls.
Yeah.
And if it's thoroughly repudiated, let's just say if it's proven beyond a shadow of doubt that there is no global warming, they'd be ecstatic, right? Obama and Gore, right? They'd be like, they'll make a big celebration. I'm joking. And Islamist peace.
Right. No, but I mean,
they want to hang on to
they would have to come up with something else for which we'd have to sacrifice next.
Absolutely right. It was global cooling, do something, and now it's global warming. Next is what? I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
How long did it take for the global cooling hype to go away?
It was in the 70s, but I don't know. I don't know.
I remember that. I mean, I'm old enough then, and I remember that. You know,
I think after the fall.
And we were going to have an ice age.
I'm sorry. After the fall of communism, I think the leftists said, let's push global warming. I mean, that's it. They had to do something.
So, Richard, what was your memory about how long it took to kind of fade away?
It was years. But, I don't remember exactly. But, in the past, I've attended some of the, what I want to call it, skeptics conferences, and they were, some of them were held in New York. And I recall, I think there was one or two authors who wrote on the issue not only of global warming, but a lot of the scare issues that come up one after another. The ALAR scare, et cetera. And I think there's a wider issue here besides even global warming, that there's an attempt to raise another scare. So after, if global warming goes away, watch for another scare to come in. And I think we have to inoculate ourselves with proper scientific epistemology, and basically better epistemology, to fight and inoculate ourselves against further scares coming up in the future. So there's a wider philosophical issue that I think we have to be aware of. I forget the author's name, but I think at one
Isn't
of the
it,
conferences,
there's
yeah,
a, there,
there
I
were
there was
two
a...
books that were mentioned.
Daisy something was one of the books?
I don't recall.
I was trying to remember. I was trying to Google here while you were talking, but I couldn't find it. Now what? Oh, Richard in the chat room says, if we colonize space, I'm sure we would have to stop the rape of the vacuum of space.
Michael writes an endless series of hobgoblins. He can't remember the author. I don't know if that's a book.
Do you remember one of the books that you're thinking of, Richard, being an endless series of hobgoblins? I don't remember that one.
That sounds like it could be.
No, I don't recall that.
Oh, okay,
but,
no,
you know,
Dixie Lee Ray. Dixie Lee Ray.
I think, but there's others beyond that. I think it's so important, a proper philosophy and a proper epistemology, we could fight the global warming. And I'm glad to see these scientists coming up with this editorial, but we have to be careful in a wider sense to inoculate ourselves against other scares. And somebody referred to the book by Crichton. There'll be others coming up, and I think we have to be on alert and be aware, and it's only a proper epistemology that will help us, get rid of all of this stuff.
I agree. And one place to get a good intro to the proper epistemology is, of course, reading Rand's works. And OPAR itself, Objectivism and Philosophy of Ayn Rand, written by Leonard Peikoff, is a good place to get a good intro to epistemology, because there is the book solely devoted to epistemology, which is called Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. But in fact, even though it's called Introduction, it's more technical than Leonard Peikoff's Introduction to the Introduction, which is in his book OPAR. The big thing, I think, is the arbitrary, the idea that people will feel a necessity to disprove an arbitrary assertion, that they feel an arbitrary assertion, which is now what global warming is, right? Once we disprove the evidence that they supposedly have for global warming, when they show them that their models are full of garbage, and yet they still say, well, I assert that global warming exists, prove that it doesn't. Yes. If they can do that, and we have to answer them because nobody has any epistemological standards, then we're totally messed up.
Correct.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Richard.
You're very welcome.
No, do,
okay.
do you still have
Take
another
care.
Point? We have time if you have another point. I'm sorry.
No. I just want to make sure that, my intention was just basically the hot spot and to raise that. And that, for me, was enough to knock this whole issue out.
Yeah, I mean, when they give you their evidence for a certain phenomenon, and then you have evidence that contradicts theirs, then you knock it out. And then if they don't have any further evidence for it, then it's arbitrary. It's done.
If they want it to be taken seriously, you've got to come back. They have to come back with a better model, better theory, and then I will listen to them. And when they don't, I'm not listening to them. And that's it. I cross them off. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Exactly.
And then they were forced to go from global warming to climate change.
Oh, yeah. They already made that change. Thanks very much, Richard. I cut him off. He was going to say one more thing. I'm not perfect at that.
No, he was going to say bye.
He was just going to say goodbye, I know, but still. So, the other thing, too, is when they say, well, there's no drastic steps that need to be taken. But somehow, even though they know it's arbitrary, I guess they feel like, well, we could do a little bit about it, or,
I'll feel better.
But really, if you are holding to true epistemological standards, you will not lift one finger. You will not lift one finger. So if I tell you, Bosch, I say, look, there's a green goblin in the other room, prove that there isn't.
There is.
You should probably have me committed, first of all. But other than that, having me committed, you shouldn't do anything.
Yeah,
you shouldn't
yeah,
go look
yeah,
for the green
yeah, but,
goblin.
Yeah, but
you
nobody's
should...
perfect. I mean.
Anyway, but yeah, we shouldn't be doing anything.
Well, the green goblin.
We shouldn't be doing anything.
That means I'm Spider-Man. If the Green Goblin's in there, that's his great villain. Anyway,
it's not like you're hedging your. But people do the same thing. I think also with respect to religion, but this is another conversation for another day. Let's go ahead and discuss our wonderful president.
Yay!
And what do we have here? Oh, we have some kind of issue in here.
Just look at it first.
Okay, we'll look at the chat room. We'll be monitoring the chat room for issues as we go into our next topic, which is our President's Wonderful State of the Union Address. And many of you are familiar with prior shreddings of Obama speeches that I've done before, and there's a lot of the same sort of things in this speech, big surprise, as in prior speeches. Calls for collectivist sentiment, calls to spend more and more money, appeals to authority, fudging of facts, all the usual stuff. And there's something in here that I noticed that was in a prior speech that Obama gave. And, you know, I found myself thinking about it in the same way that I thought last time. And then I had a further thought. So let me tell you the phenomenon. Everybody who watched the speech, first of all, if you watched the speech, I had it way easier than you guys because I refused to watch the speech. Instead, I read the speech. I read the speech way more quickly than everybody had to, like, watch it. Yeah, the applause, his expression, the heartfelt camera pans to the Warren Buffett secretary.
Again, whenever he says words a little less, I mean, when he almost whispers them, that's when he's really lying. Just for the record, whenever he does that, whenever anyone does that, they whisper a few words, they're really lying, but go on.
Yeah.
I noticed that because of the soundbite.
So, obviously, I guess maybe we should have listened to his intonation a little more, but I'm getting so sick of him.
I mean, it's all packed a lot of ice, but in particular, that's when he's really lying, when he whispers.
The thing that he started off this speech and ended the speech with, so the kind of overall theme of his speech that he was trying to carry throughout the whole thing, is that we should act like the military does.
Right?
We should all act as a unit. And he's done this in prior speeches where he's tried to use... use the values of the military and use our feelings about the military and the wonderful things that they've done for us.
That's a great point.
To make us or make politicians feel guilty about not behaving in ways that Obama insists are analogous to the way the military behaves. So let me give you an example of what I mean here. And, you know, of course he's going to talk about the military when he talks about the State of the Union, because the only real thing that he has to brag about, the only thing...
is that he allowed...
Yeah, he allowed Osama bin Laden to get killed. So he says, of course, he says, well, for the first time in 9 years, there are no Americans fighting in Iraq. And, of course, people applaud. They think that's great. But fighting, I mean, I think there's some Americans there, but they just don't happen to be technically fighting.
Technically speaking.
So that's garbage, but the fact that people aren't in Iraq, that's no great accomplishment anyway. And then he says, for the first time in 2 decades, Osama bin Laden is not a threat to this country. So here he is patting himself on the back. He says, most of Al-Qaeda's top lieutenants have been defeated. Not that, that makes any difference, because there's always, it's like whack-a-mole, there's more, ready to come.
Is that what here? He's still up there.
He says the Taliban's momentum has been broken. Of course, he doesn't mention that we're in secret negotiations. Anyway, he says these achievements are a testament to the courage, selflessness, and teamwork of America's armed forces. So, of course, he gratuitously throws in selflessness in there.
Teamwork, trying to connect us.
Being in the military should not be selfless. Of course, you should care about your country and want to preserve its safety.
No, but he likes the idea also that he gets told that because individualism, he never said that. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Teamwork.
And he says, at a time when too many of our institutions have let us down, the military, exceed all expectations. He says, they're not consumed with personal ambition. They don't obsess over their differences. They focus on the mission at hand. They work together.
Using the military.
And then he says, imagine what we could accomplish if we followed their example. And then he goes on and he lists all the things that he wants people to spend money on and vote for and all that junk, right? And I'll give you some of the most horrific in a minute. But here's the deal, right? I've thought in the past, it's like, oh, he's just trying to use this as a way to get people motivated towards his agenda. And, yeah, we'll grab a call in a second. Get people motivated towards his agenda. And really what I'm starting to think now is that he wants all of the politicians in the House, the Senate, everybody, everywhere, he wants them to behave as if they're in the military and as if he is commander-in-chief. So obviously he is actually commander-in-chief of the military, but he wants to be commander-in-chief of everything. And
of Americans.
I think the reason that I thought of this more this time that I saw him bringing this military analogy in is because he's done things where he's just grabbing power and doing things himself without the approval of Congress or the Senate.
This is a desperate point for him to try to put that about the military. I mean, he's legging on as thick as he is.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
And you know, I've talked in the past when I've analyzed the prior speech, and I can't remember which speech where he really laid it on thick, this military analogy. But I've said, look, it's not, of course, analogous.
That's a good point.
And in the military, you have one commander per unit. That commander is in charge of dictating the mission. Everyone is supposed to act to, you know, either further the mission, or if they're not on board with the mission, then they should have resigned from the military. They shouldn't be there. You know, you have agreed to help the military carry out this mission. Politics is entirely different. In politics, you're supposed to come in and disagree.
But he's
right?
No, but he's a frustrated dictator.
Yeah, you're not supposed to just shut up and obey.
Of the power of generals, especially in battlefield, they have listened to
them. So I find this speech just so revealing.
That's
because it just. Do you see? I haven't.
No, it's a.
I mean, I saw that
great,
this was a poor analogy in the past, but I didn't see it as
it's a
the fact that
it's absolutely true.
He wants to be commander in chief of everything.
Of Americans.
Yeah.
Whether they be politicians, whether they be everyone. I mean, that's the whole thing. And if we're in this together, right? I mean, you know, teamwork.
Yeah. So he really means this, you know. And
look, he is desperate, even though he has some lousy opponents. You know, coming in, the contenders, he still knows he's in deep, deep trouble come November. No matter what, no matter if Romney's there, no matter who's there.
The other thing that I noticed in the speech when he's laying out all the various things that he wants to do, he seems to be taking cues from various of the GOP candidates and incorporating whatever messages maybe their polling people think, resonate with.
If Gingrich gets applause, okay, how can we bring of that juice into this?
I mean, maybe there are some more, appeals to the policy issues of the various candidates in the speech that I didn't pick out because I did a fairly quick reading of it. But he appeals to Santorum's pet issue of manufacturing, for instance. He goes through this long thing about encouraging American manufacturers to have their manufacturing here in the United States.
And the only thing is right-wingers will go, you know, you got to give it to him.
I mean, how can Santorum stand up against Obama when Obama is better at encouraging American manufacturing than he is, right? So there's the Santorum. There is Romney's issue, which is so annoying, which is the China issue. In this speech, Obama goes on about, you know, how he has set up a new bureaucracy to investigate China.
He goes, whatever they could do, I could do better, okay?
Yeah. And then there is a little bit of discussion of the illegal immigration issue, so maybe he's going after a little bit of Gingrich there, but it wasn't totally clear. Of course, he said the name Steve Jobs in his speech because he wants to motivate us all to support
him. Without the
him.
Distraction of, you know, watching him and hearing that stinking voice, I mean, you can actually read this and really break it down, you know, which is the best way to...
Yeah, I definitely like to read it because I think he's so full of garbage.
And his whole tone, when the way he speaks is just, it's bad.
And
really
then,
bad delivery.
You know, and then he's talking about the climate change garbage, right? And
he refers to it as garbage.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it is garbage. And then he says, he wants to do all this stuff about climate change. And he says, but there's no reason why Congress shouldn't at least set a clean energy standard that creates a market for innovation.
They're being unreasonable.
He says, so far you haven't acted. Well, tonight I will. So and there's a couple places
order.
In here where he says, I'm doing stuff without Congress, and he's all proud of himself, right?
And he probably got applause for that.
Oh, I'm sure. So he says, I'm directing my administration to allow the development of clean energy on enough public land to power 3 million homes. And I'm proud to announce that the Department of Defense, working with us, the world's largest consumer of energy, will make one of the largest commitments to clean energy in history, with the Navy purchasing enough capacity to power 250,000 homes a year. And then people applaud this when he says this. They don't realize the power grab that he's making here. He's just like,
yeah, but
I'm doing
this,
I'm
doing that.
You know
why? Because they'll get a piece of that power. They'll be like, hey, I can get a little chunk of that power, and I can use it too next time.
Yeah.
That's what they think. I mean, the majority of them are there for power. Politicians, that's what they are. They're, you know, powerless, power seekers. That's what they are.
He says, in the next few weeks, I will sign an executive order clearing away the red tape that slows down too many construction projects. Because he wants to do all that construction infrastructure.
Politicians love that because, you know, yeah. Americans can see, hey, our government's working. Look, they're building a road. I mean, that road's not bad, but they're rebuilding it. And so, therefore, our tax money is being spent well. I mean, that's the whole thing. Every time they redo these streets.
I get so mad every time I drive. He had the gall to say that he's saving us from mercury poisoning after he's been part of the thing with the light bulbs. The new light bulbs, as I understand, have mercury in them, and nobody's probably going to dispose of them properly, but like he cares. Now, here's another appeal to another candidate that I wanted you to know about,
okay.
Although this is going to make you barf because this is your least favorite candidate. Which one was probably your least favorite?
Well, most dangerous, potentially, or my least favorite?
Your least favorite, just in terms of watching him speak.
It's a tie between Romney and Santorum.
What about Putzman? You forgot our favorite friend,
he's
Putzman.
He's long gone.
Okay,
he's
but I'm telling you that
he was the most annoying
in the State of the Union address.
I truly forgot about him.
Yeah, you forgot about
totally.
Putzman.
Why'd you make me remember?
Putzman.
Why'd you remind
Obama
me?
Talks about the deficit of trust. Remember
that was
the constant refrain. So he's grabbing all the catchphrases that he's seen in all the debates, and he's throwing it in his speech.
He said, what kind of applause? Okay, give me them.
Yeah. And then he's telling you how he wants to, you know, be the commander-in-chief and everything. Get a load of this one, too. He says, I've asked this Congress to grant me the authority to consolidate the federal bureaucracy so that our government is leaner, quicker, and more responsive to the needs of the American people.
Leaner, quicker.
Otherwise known as, I want to have control of everything.
And I want to bypass any kind of deals that would make with these guys.
Yeah. What does consolidate mean? I want to know what it means.
What
so,
does he mean?
I think that was, for me, kind of the biggest revelation in this, is that he clearly seems to say, look, you should behave like we're in the military. Politics, you know, that's
just listen to my orders.
Garbage.
Listen to my orders.
When this is what he says about politics. He says politics is about clinging to rigid ideologies instead of building consensus around common sense ideas.
Who's saying this?
Yeah.
Who's saying this? The politician.
The egalitarian of all time.
I mean, it's
is saying this, right? He's got his rigid ideology.
You
his rigid ideology is about being an egalitarian.
Again, I want to remind people, what profession denies that it's part of the profession. Doctors don't say, I'm not a doctor. Politicians always, I'm not a politician. And the Celtic Knish also brought that up in a piece that he wrote recently. It was just a great point. It's a great point. I'm not a politician. Politicians love saying that.
Yeah.
Because they understand it's worse than anything. I mean,
or I'm not your typical politician.
It's like a professional liars. They have to lie.
Now, but before I go on to the truly horrible and disgusting stuff, we're going to try taking a call here. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
It's Harold in Florida.
Hi, Harold. So what did you think of the State of the Union address?
I deliberately go out of my way. I feel dirty just listening to it. I didn't even like hearing you talk about it. I go out of my way to avoid. The last time I liked the presidential address.
Hello, Harold.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you have a comment on the topic of the State of the Union?
No, I absolutely do not have a comment on the State of the
Union.
Okay,
because I wanted to finish this train of thought before I go on to the next topic, okay? So I'm going to go ahead and then put you on hold.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So what I wanted to get to here was the truly most horrendous, heinous, disgusting things that was said here in the State of the Union. Of course, Obama lies. You know, he says we've agreed to more than $2 trillion in cuts and savings. Of course, over what time period has he agreed to these cuts and savings? Who knows, right? But then the other thing, too, to think about is He says, well, we have to do more than just the $2 trillion in cuts. He says, right now we're poised to spend nearly $1 trillion more, he says, on what was supposed to be a temporary tax break for the wealthiest 2% of Americans.
Can you find out who it is?
Okay. So, when he says we are spending $1 trillion on a tax break, he's saying this is America's money, whatever money you're earning that you're paying taxes on, this is just our money to spend. And so that if we give you a tax break or we continue a tax break, then we're spending money. And he uses this language right here in the State of the Union address, totally unabashedly, completely disgusting and heinous. And, you know, when he talks about, oh, we made these spending cuts, you know, $2 trillion in cuts, yeah, over 10 years, and it's never going to happen because the next Congress is going to change it. And as I understand, they haven't even passed a real budget forever well over 1,000 days.
By the way, Blockstar Radio was just booted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We had to boot somebody from the chat room. Thanks, this happens. Guys. It's because we've gotten so popular.
Yay.
We're so popular that trolls want to come in and destroy our chat room. So back on our train of thought here, I think it's truly disgusting when politicians talk about them spending money when they let us keep more of our money. It's our money. Yep. You're stealing it at gunpoint because the people, I mean, you know, Warren Buffett can talk all he wants about he wants to pay more in taxes. The reason people pay taxes is because they go to jail if they don't, pure and simple.
That's it. That really is the point.
So then he goes on with his horrible language. He says, do we want to keep these tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans? We.
He's always
trying to get through. It's about all of us deciding, right? He says, or do we want to keep our investments in everything else?
Wow.
Like education and medical research, a strong military, and care for our veterans. He says, because if we're serious about paying down our debt, we can't do both. Now, of course, by the time he's gotten to this, this is like page 12 of a 17-page speech or something, right? He's already listed a ton of different things that he wants to spend money on. So he's not serious about cutting spending.
Absolutely not. And neither is the Republicans.
Yeah.
Neither are the Republicans.
So then he lays out in the next couple of paragraphs that he has offered to Congress that he will improve so-called entitlement reform, you know, some kind of very, very attenuated semi-phase-out plan or something of entitlement, who knows, right? Some sort of entitlement reform. He's like, oh, well, I'm, you know, willing to talk about entitlement reform if you'll allow me to skin the rich. That's basically what he says in the next two paragraphs. And he says, tax reform should follow the Buffett rule. He says, if you make more than $1 million a year, you should not pay less than 30% in taxes. And he says, Washington should stop subsidizing millionaires.
Oh, man.
Can you believe he said that? Washington should stop subsidizing millionaires. We're subsidizing them if they don't pay enough taxes. In fact, most millionaires are probably creating jobs. Of course, they don't believe that, but whatever. It doesn't matter. It's their money. They earned it. And you're not subsidizing them if you let them keep more of your money. I don't know how he can, with a straight face, say this garbage.
Well, he's used to lying his entire life.
Yeah. And then he says in the next paragraph,
look where lying has gotten him. To the White House.
Lying is
not
in there. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. So then in the next paragraph, he has the effrontery to say this. He says, now, you can call this class warfare all you want, but asking a billionaire...
Asking.
And then listen to how he fudges the facts here. He says, but asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes...
Man.
That's exactly what he said. He said... Asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes, he says most Americans would call that common sense. Now, remember, we're not talking about – I mean, he isn't even talking about paying as much. It's not that the billionaire doesn't pay as much. It's
Absolutely.
That the billionaire doesn't pay as high a rate that he's all freaked out about. I'm sure the billionaire pays a lot more than the secretary.
Of course he does. He's a stinking liar. He sure as hell doesn't want to bring it up. And she was the special guest, by the way, of this.
I know. That's why I said I'm glad I didn't see the camera panning over.
They have heroes and sometimes victims, so I guess she's the victim of this year.
So then he says, he's so funny. He says, we don't begrudge financial success in this country.
Okay, that's where he whispered. I'm sorry. That's
where
he whispered. Yes,
you saw this?
We don't begrudge. You know, and that's when he's really lying his ass off. Excuse me.
Because he has a hard time getting that word out of his mouth, right?
He does. It's such a big lie that he's like, he can't even sell it.
And he says,
can you repeat that again? How We don't begrudge financial success in this country.
Who's we? Yeah.
Who's we? He does.
And then he says, when Americans talk about folks like me paying my fair share of taxes, it's not because they envy the rich. This is about envy.
Absolutely.
And this is about his egalitarian philosophy.
Sorry, think about it. He's on his heels, though. He's arguing against these things. Because, you know what I mean? In that sense, that's good. Because he has to argue against these truths.
Yeah, and he has to argue against it because he knows that these challenges have been brought up. But then he keeps, painting himself into more and more of a corner. But he doesn't care because
it will go unchallenged. I mean, he
appeals to collectivist and altruist always. Notions.
And you know what? And in a lot of ways, a lot of people still, they give it to him and say, "Well, I can't argue against that." A lot of them can't.
Yeah.
That's what he's counting on.
He says people understand that when I get a tax break, I don't need, and the country can't afford, it either adds to the deficit or somebody else has to make up the difference, like a senior on fixed income or a student trying to get through school or a family trying to make ends meet. So it's not about envy when we want to take the money from you so that you can pay for all the bloated government programs. It's just that we understand that the money's got to come from somewhere. That is a primary.
A listener types in, as a reminder, because Obama did say, Joe says, Obama once said when he worked briefly in the private sector, he felt like he was, quote, behind enemy lines, unquote. And he absolutely did say that, I think, in his book. That's what he thinks about the private sector. You know, where the Washington, that's behind enemy lines. And now you got the enemy in chief.
He's there. He's behind enemy lines. And
you know,
now
this is the commander in speech.
Yeah. Well, this speech I thought was rather revealing. And, you know, again, the premise is that everybody should be entitled to the basic bargain, which he talked about in the Sawatomi, speech for the Kansas speech, the very egalitarian speech, where he said that, everybody should grow up in the country and, hard work should pay off and you should be able to, have your house and pay for your kids to go to college and have your little car and stuff and put a little bit away for retirement. We want to make sure that everybody's basically equally well off. Right. If you're rich, we're going to tax you. And he made a point of pointing out that the ones who are going to suffer from whatever the, dream tax increase that he has in his mind, it's 98%. So, excuse me, 98% of the people won't have to pay the increase.
His father, his Muslim communist father, wanted to tax African, in the country that he was in, Kenya, 100%.
Yeah, they wanted to.
That was his dream.
Yeah. No.
He said, dreams of my father, that was his father's dream.
But the 98% that I'm talking about is something different.
I'm sorry, but that just came to mind.
98% of the people listening to him would not be subjected to the tax increase. So he's very confident that, this will be so popular among, not about envy, somebody's got to pay for this. And then if you don't pay for it, then this poor senior has to pay for it.
She's kind of on them say, well, it's not me. So that's cool, Because a lot of them will say that. Well, it's not me, so it's okay. It's not for my wallet. Thief in chief. Needless in chief.
The other thing I wanted to point out from the speech here is that he's talking about what has gone on in the Middle East and the Arab Spring. He says, as the tide of war recedes, a wave of change.
The tide of war recedes?
Yeah. A wave of change has washed over the Middle East and North Africa from Tunis to Cairo.
Change.
From Sana'a to Tripoli.
Ways of change, he means better or just change?
Change.
It's got worse.
Well, and then listen, he says, he talks about Gaddafi. He says, a year ago, Gaddafi was one of the world's longest serving dictators, a murderer with American blood on his hands.
Yeah, but he likes him.
Today, he is gone. And he says, and in Syria, I have no doubt that the Assad regime will soon discover that the forces of change cannot be reversed and that human dignity cannot be denied. And then there's all this applause.
They deny human dignity. Anyway.
Guess what he didn't mention, though?
What didn't he mention?
So he's talking about the wave of change over the Middle East. What did he not mention, which is huge to mention in this context? He talks about Libya. He talks about Syria. He doesn't talk about
Iraq.
Egypt,
right?
Because
it's going to hell.
Yeah.
Faster than the rest.
They just had the elections.
Absolutely.
We talked about
and
it
that's
last
the place
week,
that,
right?
I'm sorry, you're right. And that's the place that he made the actual submission speech at. That's the place. 2 years ago. Three years ago now. Interesting. Because it's going to hell.
No mention of Egypt in this discussion of the Arab Spring in his State of the Union. And the reason is that even he would not be able to whitewash what has gone in Egypt. He cannot sell it.
It is going.
It is garbage. The only hint that you get that he's sort of acknowledging in the next sentence, he says, how this incredible transformation will end remains uncertain. And then he says, you know, we're going to stand against violence and intimidation. We'll stand up for the rights of women, you know.
Egyptians were watching. They were like, he gypped us, you know, Egypt, anyway.
I don't know. But he's definitely evading. And as I said, he, at the end, wraps up after, again, talking about more programs that he wants to spend money on. He talks about the link with the military again, how the military are so great.
Man, what a
wreck. And that...
using the military. When doesn't he use military? In every which way?
He comes back to the SEAL team, the Bin Laden thing, you know, because this is his one triumph. Yeah. In the end, he talks about the mission that they had that day and that all that mattered was the mission. No one thought about politics. So he just wants everybody to stop thinking about politics.
So he's milking it right now.
He's going to tell you what the mission is, and you're going to shut up and fall in line and further his mission. And if you don't, I don't know.
And they buried Bin Laden, you know, with Islamic correctness somehow, some way, as far as they were concerned. Remember that? At sea, something like that. Unbelievable. Appropriately Islamic.
This is Chris. Chris says, do I think that Obama is succeeding with the public by shifting the conversation from too much spending to the rich aren't paying enough taxes? Brooks said, alarmingly, he thinks Obama came off pretty effectively. He may have come off effectively, and part of the way that Obama came off could depend on actually watching the speech. Yaron Brook took one for the team this week. He was watching and live tweeting. And I did not watch it live. As I said, I just read this thing. And when you read it, you can see right through it. And that was part of the same thing with Bush, the speech that he gave after 9/11.
Everybody thought it was so strong.
And then if you read it, you know it's wimpy.
And he avoided China, you know? Remember that? He said totalitarianism, fascism, and then he avoided communism.
Yeah, I don't know.
To not piss off the Chinese.
Yeah, but so the point being is that sometimes the speeches come off much better as delivered than as read. And when I read, I see through these guys and what they're doing
more easily. Orator, he's not. I mean, he stinks. Yeah. He has a terrible delivery. He always goes up. I mean, that's what he does. High, low, high, low.
Here's the thing. It all depends on how much people buy into the altruist morality.
And, you know, and when they can't argue against them, that's a huge problem because the majority of the country can't.
Yeah.
They can't argue against them.
We're all in this together.
And if you tell, why don't you like him? Flat out, fundamentally, why? You know what I mean? A lot of them can't really say because the other side is just as guilty.
I mean, why are we all against? Oh, the audio dropped. Can you hear us? People are saying come back. Let us know if you can hear us. The audio shut off. They're still saying. Chris says, don't leave me with these people. Okay, let us know if you're hearing us now.
Yeah, can you hear us?
Oh, now someone else says he's deaf too. We're having an audio problem and I don't know why. You know, it could be that they're shutting us off. They don't like us.
Maybe Obama was listening.
They say we're
Obama
good now.
Obama was listening. He was like, okay. Get them off.
So where did we leave you guys if we cut off? I don't know if we...
That's terrible.
That is terrible. I think that was the first time that happened to us on this platform. So
maybe we've had little glitches, but not like that.
Maybe Obama... Nothing here. Obama's saying, you know...
Rosemary says nothing here.
She doesn't have sound, but some people can hear it and some people can't. I don't know what to do except for...
I'm sorry, everyone.
I think we're going to keep going with the show on the idea that if some people are having trouble, maybe at least it's still recording, and then you could listen to the last part of the show online. In any event, judging from the alternative candidates that we have and the kind of altruism that they buy into as well, I think altruism is too popular in this country for Obama's message to not have some appeal.
No, he's reliant on it.
He's reliant on everyone's guilt.
Without that, forget about it. It's like a bad order is being reliant on bad taste. He needs it. It's his lifeblood.
Refreshing their screen worked for them, so that's really good. Let me get a few things in here about the GOP debate, some observations that I made quickly. Somebody coughed while Ron Paul talked about the gold standard, and I wondered if that was purposeful because they hate the idea of even talking about the gold standard. They talked about immigration Gingrich talked about, I think, his reasonable idea about immigration, which is that there should be something analogous to a statute of limitations for people who are here 20 plus years. What Gingrich did is he sort of improved his presentation of his position by describing these people who have been here 20 plus years as grandmothers and grandfathers.
Right.
Thus, you know, tugging on the heartstrings right. of people. Romney, you know, he tries...
Which is exceptional, so...
Yeah, Romney tries to disagree with Gingrich and then also say that he wouldn't deport grandmothers. So I don't know. He's trying to have it both ways. Ron Paul uses the immigration question as an excuse to talk about bringing the military home. So one constant theme for me throughout the debate was how many times would Ron Paul use a discussion of a domestic issue as a reason to bring in a foreign policy point, and that happened several times. I said for him, thankfully, or I said for his wife, thankfully, Ron Paul didn't discuss foreign policy with regard to his wife being the best first lady or whatever question they were asked. At least he didn't do that.
That's right.
He
says she'll be commander-in-chief.
Yeah. Now, in terms of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they went back and forth, you know, who had an investment in that and who didn't. And
supposedly Santorum does. I don't know.
I think they probably all have mutual funds that might have some tie into it.
If no one knows about it, they'll just use it against the other guy.
Well, and then talk about your kind of class warfare rhetoric. Newt played into that by calling his investments a tiny mouse in relation to Romney's elephant.
Right.
Romney, he keeps upping the ante on this pro-capitalist, pro-success, pro-profit
rhetoric. He knows that works
rhetoric.
On the right.
Yeah.
That works. So he'll keep spewing it, even if he doesn't believe it.
Yeah, and he says that the GOP candidates should not castigate those who are successful, and he's right. But then, of course, when he talks about these things, he doesn't let a minute go by. He always talks about his charitable contributions.
Yes. And that justifies it, you know?
Yeah.
That justifies wealth creation.
So I'm successful. Of course, I contribute to charity.
Okay.
You know?
I was like, okay.
Newt had a revealing statement. He says, my goal is to shrink the government to fit the revenue.
That's what he said?
Yeah, he's going to shrink the government to fit the revenue. Now, obviously, it's better than having a government that's bigger than the revenue. Why is that the standard? You know, it's just garbage. So, you know, for me, I would say, well, how about shrinking the government more and use anything that's left over to actually pay down the debt?
Get the hell out of the way.
Yeah.
Get out of this sector, out of that sector,
And that just reinforces my thought, which is that any of these guys are going to try to keep spending up to the amount of revenue at least.
He was neutered.
Santorum says he's going to reduce the budget every 4 years, every year for 4 years, until he gets a balanced budget. Why not just balance it year one?
Because they're politicians.
And be done with it, right? They had that long discussion about the space program, and Ron Paul got a good laugh in there because he says he'd like to maybe send, you know, some politicians up to space. You know, he says, I don't think we should go to the moon. We should send some politicians there, which I, of course...
Pretty funny.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic with that from time to time.
I mean, she should go as well, but that's pretty funny.
But, you know, Gingrich is the one who's more for spending on this. And he says, of course, he uses the word leverage, which means that the government spends a little, but supposedly then private companies spend even more. Right. But he's still talking about spending our
money.
None
of them are serious except for Ron Paul when it comes to cutting
and
spending. None of them. And it's sick that the crazy guy makes and they don't. It's a major issue.
And they're only doing it mostly because they're in Florida. This is why the space program is being brought up in the first place.
Right,
phony. Pandering. And his reason is that we need to make sure that we attain a symbolic victory over China. And I forget which milestone it was. We had to beat China first with respect to some, you know, space milestone. Santorum says we need NASA to inspire kids to get involved in science and math.
We need a government institution to inspire kids.
And my thought is, well, first of all, I think we've seen with some of the private contests that they've had, SpaceX or I forget the names of these, but there have been private spaceships built, so it can be done. But also, I think someone like Steve Jobs is inspiring kids to get involved in science and math. We don't need a government program to do it. So a bunch of phony stuff.
But they're not politicians. They keep telling us. These politicians, they say they're not politicians, so therefore they're not politicians, right?
That's right. Oh, gosh. There was one woman who her question essentially was, will you promise me free health care? And luckily, none of them actually promised her free health care.
Yeah, but Romney, you know.
But none of them have promised a clean repeal of Obamacare.
No.
Santorum sounds like he's the closest, but I'm not sure what his final position
is. But also
is.
Something else for, you know, for that personal issue. But Romney, one of his advisors, said that we're not going to repeal Obamacare. I mean, we really can't do that, you know. And why wasn't Romney questioned about this? They have more information than we do, than the audience does. Why didn't Gingrich challenge him? So your guy, one of your advisors, said you cannot repeal it. What do you say to that? Instead, it goes unsaid.
Listen to Gingrich. You know, Gingrich will say he wants to repeal Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, etc. But then he says we need
real
health
reform. How about get the hell out of the way?
And there was a tweet around the last debate, which I thought was probably apt here, that said, you know, yeah, your bill, the Obamacare bill, Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, is 2,700 pages. Mine will be only 2,400 pages.
Right.
You know, it'll be so much better.
Right.
Romney, in effect, invites states to create their own Romney care systems, but, you know, he'll repeal Obamacare, but maybe they'll just all do that at the state level. At least Santorum called him on that and said that it's the same whether you've got it at the state or the federal level.
He did call him out, which is good, and
yeah.
It's sad that it was Santorum, but whatever. You gotta bludgeon him with Romney care. I mean, you have to knock him out. I mean, that's it. I mean, Obama, what? Again, you got, you know, I don't know.
I don't know who to hope for.
You have a socialist versus a socialist. The socialist will win. He's the real deal.
Yep.
The other guy's pretending to be something else.
I'm going to give you my favorite Ron Paul stretching to get foreign policy into the debate.
Okay.
Question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
They asked them, and it was because they're in Florida. They said, "Are you going to have Hispanics in your administration?" So Ron Paul talks about, Hispanics like my foreign policy of non-intervention, so I think I'll have some in my in my administration.
You know why?
That was such a stretch. I thought if you're having that drinking game, like every time that Ron Paul brings foreign policy into a domestic issue, you're going to drink. That is worth two shots.
Absolutely.
Right there.
And also one thing, though. Ron Paul, he must be getting desperate because he knows that there are all idiots in the audience who will applaud his stupid foreign policy statements. So he was getting hungry. He was like, keep bringing up foreign policy. That's what I get applause. That's it. Whereas his backers are like, oh, Ron.
Yeah. I mean, he does get a lot of applause, but does he deserve it? No. He went so far in this debate as to say that people were overreacting and over-concerned about jihad. Now, that's...
And he actually used the term. Jihadists.
Well, he used the word jihadist.
As if they're the boogeyman under our bed.
It was funny because I tweeted this out. I said, Ron Paul says we are overreacting and over-concerned about jihad. And then I say, of course, what was 9/11? We shouldn't be so concerned. And some so-called fact-checking Twitter account, whatever, he didn't use the word jihad. And I knew he used the word jihadist in a way that was laughing at people who were concerned about them.
But he was acknowledging a reality, which the old guys don't do.
Yeah. And so what I did is I waited until I could see the CNN transcript from it. And this is what Ron Paul actually said. And you know how he does in kind of his little giggly way when he does this, right?
I call him the giggler. I made a cartoon.
Yeah, he says the American people, I don't think they see a jihadist under the bed every night. Ha, Yeah, it'd be silly to think that there's jihadists.
And also one thing, Rush Limbaugh brought up this week also that Rick Santorum, Rick Santorum was showing a little passion about Romney care and Obamacare. And Romney said something like, you don't got to get so angry about it, you know, and that's the problem.
He says, I don't think that you should get angry about a mandate. Yeah.
Right.
Romney, government mandates are getting angry about. And to me, I say, yes, they are, because they violate individual rights. Now, we've got a lot of people talking in the chat room. We're going to wrap up here. People in the chat room are saying that any of these guys are better than Obama.
Look, Obama's the worst
possible.
We're
going to see this
That's
week.
A fact.
Yeah, we're going to see which one is going to win this week in Florida,
Look,
and that might turn
come
the tide.
November, I don't want to say anything to anyone who knows. Endorse, no way. Come November, We have to make a choice in that booth as Americans. It doesn't matter who, what, but we know who we have to vote against.
Hold our nose, vote, drink a lot afterwards.
Just to hold on.
That's probably what it's going to be. So I will continue to bring you the ugly truth. During the week, you can check out my blog at don'tletitgo.com. You can follow this show on Blog Talk Radio by clicking the follow button. Come to the Facebook page, the Don't Let It Go Unheard Facebook page. I share articles and stuff there through the week as well. There's a lot of ways to stay in touch. Oh, yeah, there's Amy Peekoff on Twitter, too. So thanks, everyone. You have a good week. I have to tell you, I'm not going to be here next week. I'm going to take a week off for a Super Bowl Sunday party. So if there's any past episodes, maybe listen to those. I'll be sending out articles in the chat, but I'll see you in 2 weeks from tonight. Have a good evening.
Take care.